Peter Thomas Fornatale here. Before we get started today, just want to give a special word about our friends, our founding partner, the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. We started these shows just about a year ago, had no idea how things were going to go, and the very first partner slash sponsor we got involved with was the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. That means so much to me. The year's turned out great. It's been terrific. We've exceeded our own expectations in terms of how many people are listening. At the time, we didn't know how it was going to go. Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation believed in us. We believe in them. The TRF is always in need of support. If you like our show, if you like the fact that you don't have to pay for our show, you know, a lot of podcasts giving out gambling information would be behind a paywall at Patreon or something like that. That's not the way we want to roll. We want to give this show to you, the listeners, for free. And how we can do that is through sponsors and partners like the TRF. Take some time, if you will, and make a donation, trfinc.org/players. That's the best way to do it, so we get the credit. trfinc.org/players. Hello and welcome to the In the Money Players podcast. Today is Wednesday, January 15th. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornatale, coming to you from the Brooklyn Bunker once again. And we've got another one of these special shows today where I sit down with a horse player and talk about his or her time in the game, lessons that have been learned, in the hopes of helping you, the listeners, out, and also to help provide the basis for this book I'm working on, the tentative title, Using Heavy Irony, being Easy Game. Of course, in reality, it's anything. But I am going to try to tack on a little piece at the end here today with our buddy Jason Beam, because he's got the Beamy Awards coming up. That will be after the body of the show. We're going to start out by bringing in a man who's no stranger to these In the Money airwaves. He's helped out in particular on our Keeneland shows over the last couple of meets, from Lexington, Kentucky, Sean Borman. Sean, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Pete. How are you?
I'm doing well, and I'm really excited about this. A lot of the folks I have had on for these type of shows are people I've interviewed in the past for other projects. You were an important consultant on the Mike Maloney book, but I've never actually interviewed you, maybe briefly for an article or two, but never at this length. And I'm really curious to get you talking about your time in the game. And we'll start off with an easy one. When did it begin?
Probably, I mean, my interest began late 90s, I'd say. I first went to Keeneland in probably 1994, 95 with a friend. We cut school. I think I've told you that story, actually. We went to a Catholic school and we cut school, and the first person we bump into is the damn priest in the paddock. So we had to dodge him all day. That was the first time I went, and then I got seriously interested in the game, you know, almost immediately, and began reading all the books you could read, and you know, I would say was fairly serious into handicapping by 1998, 1999, something like that.
And how old are you now, for the listeners?
I will be 40 in June.
Okay. Almost a proper adult now. I mean, I'm impressed.
Almost. Yeah. I'm a man. I'm 40.
People ask me all the time, you mentioned learning from books, about what books to read. I've had this conversation multiple times in the last few weeks. What would you recommend if somebody asked you that question today, as I'm sure people do when they hear about your quixotic profession? We degenerates have a way of finding each other, and the budding degenerates have the way of finding people like you. What do you tell them? Where should they begin?
You know, I don't know exactly where to begin. I just read everything I could find. You know, here in Lexington, at least back then, they had a pretty good selection of handicapping books at bookstores. So I would just go find new ones. You know, the Steve Davidowitz books, obviously Andy Byers' books. Even some of those old, was it Tom Ainsley?
Sure.
His books. State Listen has some good ones. And I would just read anything and everything and try to learn something from every one of them. I there's probably not one out there that I haven't at least leafed through at some point. I've always thought that Davidovich's Betting Thoroughbreds was a great sort of starting off point because he hit most topics you could think of generally, and then you could sort of just start there and start to move forward on what you wanted to sort of focus on after that. But I thought that was a great sort of beginner's guide book. Yeah, there was an update recently, or relatively recently. But I think he even has a chapter in that book on just how to read the form, you know, what everything means and stuff like that, which, you know, to new players is important because it's sort of like hieroglyphics.
Yeah, we take it for granted, but you're right, just getting the basic explanation. And I know that is in some of those books. None do that piece of it better than the Davidovich book. And I'd also mention, it was probably after your time, you might have been too advanced to read Brad Free's Handicapping 101 when it came out. But that was another book that I think does a really good job dialing down into the fundamentals and getting folks started on their journey. Did you ever read that one?
You know, I think I did. I think that's one of the ones I just sort of like leafed through and tried to pick up on things that maybe I hadn't read before, but it came out a little past my beginning stages. So, but I'm familiar with it to some degree. Yeah.
You talked about reading the form and learning the data that everybody sees. I know you're a believer in creating your own data. You make your own speed figures. What is so important about having your own data to you as opposed to using the data everybody else has and maybe trying to focus on the betting side of the equation?
Well, I think you can just learn a lot from specifically making figures and just pouring through race charts, reading the comment lines and just trying to pay attention to, you know, what trainers are running good, what jockeys are running good, you know, who's getting price horses home, you know, where those horses are coming from on the racetrack to detect any kind of bias. And you can do all that through the figure making process. So to me, it just provides a deeper insight into what's going on at whatever circuit you're following. And it provides an edge to some degree. I think it used to provide a bigger edge than it does now, but it's still useful information.
Your approach to figure making is different in a few ways that I want to ask about. One thing I know in particular is you're making pace figures as well as final figures. Why do you think that isn't more prevalent, and what's the benefit of it?
I mean, it's becoming more and more prevalent, I would say, with Timeform US and some of these other services. But I think, you know, the final time figure is very often determined by the pace of the race. I mean, it's not just a one-step process. I mean, you know, some races go extremely fast early and slow late, but that can still produce a fast final time just because there's, you know, I think of it as like there's ranges that horses can do things in. You know, there's only so fast a quarter can go in, and really with halfway decent horses, there's only so slow it can go in too. I mean, you're not going to see Thoroughbred go in 28 for the opening quarter. And the same thing throughout the stages of each stage of the race, they're not going to finish extraordinarily slow, and they're not going to finish extraordinarily fast, even if they have a very slow pace in front of them. So there's ranges that these animals can bounce back and forth in. And it just, the final time is so dependent on how they get there. To me, it's very important to know those figures and know how the final time is, you know, how they get it. So just having the final time number doesn't tell the whole story to me.
By looking at the component pace, you get a much more fuller understanding of what actually happened in that race, and that might be a better indicator of a certain horse's ability. Let's say the final time isn't that great, but the horse is contesting a fast pace the whole time and still manages to hold off the closers. That's an effort that you just look at that one number of a final time, it might be misleading.
Right. And also, you know, a horse can run very fast early. Let's say a horse gets loose and it's just a really fast horse and sets blazing for action and runs really fast final times. A great example of this, in my opinion, is Chancelot. You know, very fast horse, doesn't have much finish. So when that horse gets hooked or runs up against a horse like Mattoli, who can get to the half basically as fast as he can if he wants to, but still finish, that horse is going to get beat, you know, 9 times out of 10, in my opinion. So just knowing the Chancelot's the fastest thing in the world on final times, but not knowing how he gets to the final time can lead to some mistakes in your betting and your handicapping, in my opinion.
Mattoli's a good one to take right next in a question, because that's a horse who, for me, early in the career, was running with these fairly slow paces. And I had questions about early in the year last year when JK was already, correctly, as it turned out, proclaiming him the Breeders' Cup Sprint Champion. But I remember talking to, if I'm remembering this right, I remember talking to you about him, and you were closer to JK's point of view, because while he was contesting these slow-ish paces, he was still putting up really good final time figures and finishing his races. Am I remembering that right?
Yes, although it took him a while to come around to where he could finish. Finish as, you know, he could always finish, but it took him a while to get to where he could finish as a grade one horse should finish. So I think I want to say it was going into maybe the race on Derby Day. I was a little skeptical of him just because he was running slow paces and still not finishing like a grade one horse. But then once he proved he could finish and he sort of blossomed some more, to me, he was a more complete racehorse and a much bigger threat. But I actually think I was looking to bet against him one of those days.
Yeah, I think you just got on the train a race quicker than me, I think is what happened. You'd seen that component pace figure of what he was doing late in the race, and I think it put you on a little bit earlier, whereas I remained skeptical and let him kick me in the teeth one more time, unless maybe out of deference to JK, I might have thrown him on a ticket and saved my bacon at some point. Another thing I wanted to ask you, and this is going deep into the figure-making process, but I've heard you have some really interesting conversations about this with fellow figure makers over the years. Your approach seems a little bit different. And correct me if I'm wrong, but you seem a little bit less willing to split variance and make the numbers all make sense for each individual horse in the race. And you seem a little bit more pointed towards trying to figure out what the methodology is telling you overall in terms of what was a fast race, what was a slow race. Is that accurate? And talk about how your approach is a little bit different than some other figures, specifically commercial figure makers.
Yes, that is accurate. I don't want to project a final figure just for the sake of making it make sense as to what the horses were running previously. If the data is telling me that it, you know, if the data is telling me it should be a slow race because they just crawled home, and, you know, in my opinion, good horses shouldn't finish slowly if they get good setups. I mean, that to me, something's wrong if that happens. So I'm not just going to say, you know, this happens a lot of turf racing with my figures where the, you know, the pace will be soft and the final time will come back really slow. And, you know, I want to know if they finish that final quarter in 22-3, you know, that's probably an okay race. If they finished it in 23-3, then that's not a good race. And I'm not going to project that figure up just because the horse was running 88s or 90s. I'm just going to leave it as a 78 and say it's a slow race, because that gives me a betting opportunity perhaps. And I'll do that with name horses. I'll do that with, you know, Uni and horses like that. To me, didn't always run super fast finals. But what I'll do is I'll rely on my late pace figure to tell me if it's a good race or not. So if the final is very slow, but the late pace number is, you know, what a grade one horse should run for a 10 claimer, you know, if the late pace figure is what is better than par for the class level, then I'll accept that. I'll know why the final time was slow. It was just because the pace was slow. Whereas I think you get into trouble with some of these figures that just show you a final time when they're projecting these numbers. It's not an accurate representation of how fast that race really went. So yeah, long story coming back around. I do less projections and less variant changes than most figure makers, I think.
And I think it makes sense that having that extra element of the pace figure to help tell the whole story, you don't need to project as much because it's making sense to you as it is. And I suppose in your view, it's more accurate to let those component pace pieces of the race tell you the whole story than just trying to gauge the horse's ability by, let's face it, in some cases with these projections, pulling a number out of thin air.
It is to me, yes. And the more you make your own information, the less you want it to be like all the other information that's out there, just because there's no edge in having the same information and the same figures and the same thoughts on track bias as everybody else. You know, when you hop on Twitter in mid-August and there's 15 tweets about, you know, Golden Rail at Saratoga or last meet, how dead the rail was, you know, that's a sign to me to look and see, well, is it really dead or is it just perceived to be dead? So you just kind of differentiate your opinions and that just leads to betting opportunities.
Let's talk about Saratoga specifically. Did you think there were, as a whole, or certain days where the rail wasn't as dead as people like me were thinking it was?
I think there were, but I think in general, everybody was just correct about Saratoga last year. I think most of that meet, the rail was pretty terrible. And really, you know, Paul and Duke Matisse have touched on this a lot too, that the most dirt tracks now, the rail is a disadvantage on the majority of days. I don't really know why that is. It really is. It's totally different than the way I came up, you know, when dead rails were pretty rare, good rails were all over the place.
It must be related to safety, or I shouldn't say safety. It must be related to perceptions about safety. And it's a great question to have a track man on to talk about at some point. I don't know who the right candidate for that is. We can do a little crowdsourcing here on the podcast. If somebody knows a track man who might be able to speak eloquently about why these tracks have changed, I wouldn't be surprised if there are some out there who think we're crazy and it hasn't changed, but I would think there are some who'd be able to speak honestly about this and explain why they think having a slower rail maybe makes for safer racing. I'd be definitely curious to dive more into it, but I think this leads to a good opportunity to just ask you about bias in general. Is it something that you use frequently in your horse playing in 2020?
Yes and no. I've gotten to where I really want to make 100% sure it's a real bias now. You know, I think in years past, I was more apt to just, you know, use my visual race watching skills to say it was a bias. But the more I got into some of the pace figures and late pace figures, I've learned that, you know, sometimes it's not really a bias. Sometimes it's just the ability of the horses that I didn't fully understand. So now I really want to make sure it's a true bias that's dictating outcomes before I say it's a bias. So it, you know, I rely on it a little less than I used to, but I still I still rely on it, and it still exists.
I would imagine that a tool like Twitter that allows the whole world to know what's going on the Saratoga racetrack sort of necessarily makes that information less valuable, like you were saying. So maybe you bake it in a little bit, but you can't lean on it too much because the whole world is seeing it. Is that accurate? As biases have become more talked about, has that made them less important to you?
It has a little bit, just because if my friends that aren't serious horse players are texting me about bias that they've seen on Twitter, it almost has to be priced in. You know, I just refuse to believe that some of these algorithms and computer teams and syndicates aren't picking up on stuff before some of the Twitter guys do. But maybe they're not. Maybe it still matters.
I want to talk about your betting, and we'll start off with pools that you do well in versus pools that you do not do well in. What pool overall do you think you do best in?
Historically, I've done best in the tries and supers. And I say historically because the last couple of years, that's really starting to change. I think those pools have gotten more efficient, and I've been, too slow to adapt to that, honestly. So, now I'm trying to focus more of my handle in the pick pools and the horizontal pools. But, historically, it's been tries and supers.
Where do you think your edge came from when you were doing well in those vertical pools, and what do you think happened to it?
I think I think my edge came from in those pools was really just sitting alongside Mike Maloney for all those years, because he is a tremendous constructor of bets, and he understood how to play those pools long before most people did, and just sort of watching him constructing those tickets and learning how to do it properly and how to allocate your betting resources in an efficient way provided a huge edge, even though, those were the highest takeout pools. There was just more dumb money in those pools than others. That's sort of gone away now that, there's more tools to bet those pools properly. There's far more computer teams betting those pools than they used to be, and some of that inefficient money is just dried up.
What about betting weaknesses historically? Is there a pool that you've struggled with over the years, or one that maybe took you a while to conquer?
I would think I was probably the weakest in the horizontal pools, and I don't think it was necessarily I was bad at it, but I never liked to be involved in those pools because it just tied money up. I never had a huge bankroll to work off of, so I didn't want to tie up my betting dollars for that particular day in a pick five or pick four and not be able to bet the tries and supers I knew I could do well in. So I think just that sort of dynamic led me to bet those pools less frequently, and that just led to me being weaker when I did bet them.
As the horizontals have become more important to your game, where do you think you're finding an edge?
I think you can find an edge multiple ways, but I think when my figures are different than what's published, there's always an edge there. I think most of my edge now would come from just a better understanding of pace and pace scenarios, and finding sort of horses that are a little hidden but can take advantage of today's pace scenario better than some of the shorter priced horses can. And that's where I think, in my opinion, the most value I'm seeing at the races right now is just finding is on the win end. I think you can cook a fade extremely well with a 6 or 8 to 1 shot that you can lock into in a pick sequence versus 15 years ago getting that 6 or 8 to 1 shot just to hit the board in a try with logical horses. You're going to get underpaid if that horse doesn't win. You're even going to get underpaid if the horse does win and you get logicals in second and third in the try. But I think in a pick 3 or pick 4, you could still find a lot of value there with those type of horses.
That's interesting. What about win bets on those horses? Do you feel like you're getting an outsized reward in the pick, and that's why the pick is worth it despite the more risk?
I'll typically do both now. I'm betting to win a lot more than I used to, just because things are harder to hit now, in my opinion. I just think it's harder to convert on a pick three or pick four than it used to be. They might not be harder to hit, but if your strike rate is the same and the payoffs are slightly depressed, then it's not as good a wager. So what I'll do is take a little bit more of my bet and bet it to win on the price horse I like versus playing it all in a pick season.
That makes sense to me. What about wagering mistakes? Are there any wagering mistakes you've made consistently throughout your career?
How long is this podcast going to be?
As long as you need it to be. We can make it a two-parter.
I think the ones I have made consistently is not, getting beat in spread races in a pick sequence has been a consistent thorn in my side for years and years. 15 mistakes a day in my betting. I mean, it's very hard to, it's a hard thing to do perfectly. It's impossible to do perfectly. But, I'm always questioning the way I've played and decisions I've made. So I can't think of any specific, consistent mistakes other than the getting beaten spread races thing. But, I'm always making mistakes.
You're revealing a lot about your character here. I'm sensing a real perfectionism, because one could consider a mistake, quote unquote, anytime you don't write a bet perfectly. And I love the fact that you're revealing that you go back and look at every, it sounds like you look at every bet you make and say, hey, how could I have done that better? And I would imagine that exercise, all in all, helps hone your axe and make you a much better player, even though it sounds like it's a bit frustrating at times.
Yeah, it's incredibly frustrating because it's, the way I bet, and I've always bet, is, every outcome is dependent on a decision I've made, a handicapping decision I've made, or more importantly, a betting decision I've made at the window. So it's, you always feel like you've screwed something up, or at least I do.
Can you think of an example?
It drives you nuts. Can I think of an example?
Something you did recently.
During the Keeneland Fall Meet. And I'll preface this by saying I've had a pretty bad stretch of gambling for the longest bad stretch I've been in my entire life. Still going through it to some degree, although it's starting to turn around a little bit. But I've been going terrible, and I feel like I've sort of fallen behind my peers in terms of betting smart. Betting decisions and profitability, certainly. So there was a pick five during the Keeneland Fall Meet, and I can't remember, it was during the week, it was like a Wednesday or a Thursday. And, I wrote, a handicap sequence, I wrote my tickets down, I plugged it into my, ExpressBet account. I mean, I typed it in, and it was going to cost $500 or $600 or something. And, while I had the money to make the bet in my account, I just didn't feel like I needed to be spending $600 on this one bet at a time when, things had been going bad. So I just didn't, I hit clear instead of submit. And I would have hit it for over $20,000 if I remember right. It was a huge mistake. But at the same time, as much as that drove me insane, I know from experience it's always better to to save capital and preserve the capital than it is to just fire it, you know, willy-nilly. And the reason I made that decision is just because I second-guessed myself so much. Just because things have been going bad. And when things start going bad, it's snowballing. And it's, you know, it's all your decision-making that leads to that snowball. Then sometimes it's just hard to pull the trigger. But I've known for well over a decade that it's perfectly okay to pass a winner like that, even though that one in particular stung really badly. Because there's always going to be another opportunity, and there's always going to be another pick-by sequence that looks okay, and on and on it goes.
This is an important issue, preservation of capital, that I haven't really read much of anything about in any handicapping book. Maybe Mike in Betting with an Edge touches on it. But I'd like to hear you talk about that, having a dedicated bankroll and preserving it and growing it over a period of time. How do you approach that, and what are your general thoughts on the importance of preserving capital?
Well, I think it's, you know, if you're playing for a living and you've got, you know, your living depends on the ability to make wagers and to cash tickets, then the worst possible thing you could do is go broke, because you've got no way to make a living. I mean, it's not, you know, if I go broke, I can't just go to work on Monday and say, well, you know, I can work for 6 months and save up another little bankroll and go back at it. Now, that's a hell of a lot smarter way to play this game than it is the way I do it. But you've got to always be around, and you've always got to be able to have the ability to make a bet. And, you know, one of the great things about this game is there's no forced action. You don't have to make a bet. There's no ante like poker. You can sit there and sit there and sit there as long as you can, you know, pay your bills. And wait for a great opportunity to make the bet. So, you know, having gone broke a few times in my life early on, I quickly learned how important it is to never let it happen again. And that's just preservation of capital. And if you have to pass what are winning bets, as maddening as that is, you've just got to do that. You've got to construct your bets when you do bet in ways that can increase the return. You know, obviously you want to increase your returns and make profit, but even if you just get your bet back, if you can construct your ticket in a way to where you're, you know, only half right but get 75% of your money back or all of your bet back and break even instead of lose, that to me is a very positive thing.
It's interesting talking about the different approaches within one bet, where you're going to be allocating part of it to make a huge score and another part of it to keep you in action. Those are very complicated thoughts, and I wouldn't mind hearing a little bit more on that front from you.
Well, it's just, you know, to me, it just all goes back to what we've talked about is preservation of capital. I mean, you've got to just stay around and stay in the game. You know, if you can construct your trifecta or superfecta in a way that if your key horse runs fourth, you still cash your ticket instead of, you know, saying you've got to be first or second or just picking a horse to win and then playing some horses underneath it. If you can just, you know, you might have to spend a little more money to do that, but, you know, if you can bet $600 and be half right or mostly wrong and still get 600 back versus betting 300 and getting nothing back, that's better to me. And it allows you to stay in the game, make more wagers, and give yourself that opportunity to really score eventually.
Well, and that's the important thing I wanted to have you talk more about. You're not talking about making a bet with that as the goal. That's just a safety net built into the bet. But you're not limiting your upside when you're doing that. You still have a portion of that 600 that has the opportunity to yield 10,000 or whatever it is. That's the idea that I think a lot of people might misinterpret when you're talking about this.
Absolutely. No, yes, you've got to, you take, you know, and I know Mike talks about this in his book, and he's who I learned this from, and after watching him for a long time, you know, you allocate, you determine how much you want to bet, first of all. You know, say, I want to bet X amount into this trifecta or into this race or whatever. And then you determine if you're going to bet a race, you know, if you like a specific race, you know, do you want to play just a win bet? Do you want to play exactives and a win bet? You want to play everything, exactly, trifecta, super? You know, you can use the pools. You can use different pools as hedges to your name opinion. And then you got to determine how much you want to hedge and how much you want to allocate to that hedge. So, you know, I'm just trying to think of an example. If you like two horses and you think they're most likely going to run in the tri, but you want to also play a little super if they run first and fourth, so you get some money back, or if they run second and fourth, or even if they run third and fourth and logicals finish first and second, you know, you might want to have 25 to 40% of your bet allocated to those combinations, and 25% allocated to your better combinations if they run first and second or first and third, and then, you know, 10 to 15% allocated to where if they run first and second and the horse you like the best to run third runs third, you better have a portion of your bet allocated to that kill combination to where you can really score. So it's just, you know, it's just using your betting dollars to pound your main opinion and hedge secondary opinions, and just sort of blend all that together into one bet and one scenario, basically.
Folks interested should check out Betting with an Edge. Mike goes into detail about how he does this, but Sean just said it in a very articulate way as well. And hopefully it's sophisticated stuff, but it's a really important concept that I think might change the way some listeners think about bet structure. You talked about the mistake of getting beat in spread races. What is your opinion? Let's define that first for listeners. Talking about a race, how do you define a spread race? How many horses are you talking about using in a horizontal?
I don't have a specific number of horses, but it's just a race where the abilities of the competitors are very bunched up and jumbled, and you can't really say one horse stands above the others. And there's sort of two ways to deal with races like that. You either find one you think is better than the others and single it. I think Garrett Steva talked about that recently on his interview, where, you know, he's more apt to single in a spread race and spread in a single race as a contrarian way to play the races. And that's really smart, you know, because if most gambling dollars are going to be five deep in a 12 horse, you know, maiden race on the grass at Saratoga, and you can be one deep and be right, you're a lot more efficient and have used your money a lot smarter. But to me, you know, the races where you can't do that, where you really do need multiple horses, my biggest mistake is always saying, well, I need six, but I'm just going to use five, or I'll just use four because I don't want to spend the extra money on those other two combinations, and they get me every time. every time.
I was going to ask what your opinion is about doing a modified all in that situation. I've really warmed to the idea of the modified all, not an all every horse equally, but a race where you have at least, if you're talking about the ABCX, Steve Crist, Barry Meadow method of making horizontals, you have at least every horse as a C, and then you go back and you press the ones that you have an opinion on, or maybe you don't have that strong of an opinion, but you know they're going to pay a lot less, and you don't want to lose equity if they win. Where are you with the all ball?
I think there's nothing wrong with using a weight at all. Which is, I believe, what you're talking about, where
Correct.
You've got everything covered, but in different denominations.
Yes, exactly.
And I think specifically, it's a good strategy if you've got sort of a separator single in that sequence. If you've got a 6-to-1 shot that you really like, that can provide separation in the pool and value for your play, you know, you don't want to lose that bet. If that horse wins, you don't want to get knocked out by a horse that you should have had in a race where you don't have an opinion. You could really miss out on a big score that way. And I've done that plenty of times too.
But it sounds like that's a different scenario when you're getting beat in spread races. Maybe these are races where you don't have that separator in another leg to drill into, and you're just trying to piece your way through the sequence, or it's a sequence you're playing because there's a mandatory payout or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, the ones that are the ones that really come to mind are like big pick sixes, mandatory payout type stuff, where you know you just need to hit the bet and you're going to get paid. It's not necessarily I'm making a bet to, I've got a good single and I'm trying to maximize value that way. It's just it's one of those scenarios where there's a bunch of extra money in the pool. You know the value's there and you know it's going to pay well as long as you can hit it. If you can just get all the puzzle pieces to line up right, it's going to, you'll get value. And those are the ones where get beat in a spread race. It's just brutal. If I remember right, there was a time back at Oaklawn where Mike and I had played, pretty significant pick six play back in the good old days of the $2 classics or whatever. Maybe it was a dollar classics. I can't remember. But, the good pick sixes. And they had a big carryover, and I think it was about 2 days in a row where we went 5 of 6 and got beat in the spread race, and nobody had it, just kept carrying. And those have always stuck out in my mind.
Oh my goodness. Let's talk about the Rainbow Empire, whatever they are, the modern pick six. Will you ever play it when it's not the mandatory payout day, first of all?
Yes, I will.
What are the circumstances under which you'll play it on the non-mandatory day? And then we'll pivot to talk about how your approach changes, which I think you've already tipped your hand, but we'll go there anyway on the mandatories. But start off with the circumstances that would have you play it despite the usurious takeout. Are those days where you think you might be able to sweep and hit the jackpot?
No, it's actually the opposite. I think, the days where I don't think anybody can sweep, and I think it'll pay. I can make a small bet and still get 10 or 12 times my money and not, know that I'm not going to be some idiot that, has it twice but calls himself the jackpot because I know it's not going to pay much,
I'm laughing. I'll tell you why I'm laughing in a minute. But all right, I'll interrupt now. There is a story, the benefactor, the reason this book is happening, Matt Miller, does have that story where he cost himself the jackpot. It was a smaller one. It was at Arlington, but he did cost himself the jackpot because he had 2 winning tickets one day. It'll be a good story for the book, but I have to laugh. But anyway, continue about the theory of playing it on those days when it doesn't seem like anybody's going to hit the thing.
So, I'll play on, and I'm not talking about any kind of serious investment. It's a very small investment. And yes, I know the takeout is totally absurd. But I'm not putting much money into it. And it's just an opportunity in my eyes to get an asymmetrical payoff on a small bet. If I have opinions, if I have opinions in 4 of the legs and I can bet $100 and maybe get back $1,500. To me, that's fine. I don't really care that only $50 of my $100 investment is actually quote working for me. It doesn't matter because I look at takeout as what is my cost of a wager over the course of a year going to be, and I know the way that I play and the rebates that I get. I know basically what it's going to cost me over the course of a year to play the horse, and so I don't. really worry about each individual bet in terms of takeout.
That's an interesting approach.
The main time, well, you know, I think of it more like a stock portfolio. You know, some stuff, there's going to be higher transaction fees on some of your stock purchases and whatnot than others. But as long as you have a general idea of what you're going to pay to play, you know, that's how I look at it.
To clarify, though, game selection really comes into it. You were talking about a very specific reason to play a bet with a de facto 50% takeout. You are conscious of what the takeout is in those pools, and unless there's extraordinary circumstances or very unusual, maybe not quite to the level of extraordinary, you're going to be very price conscious and avoid unfair takeout scenarios, true or false?
Absolutely, yes. I'm always aware of what it costs to play. But there's just times where I'm willing to pay it if I think there's a lot of dead money in the pool, or, you know, and that's where I was getting ready to say is the main times I will play those bets on non-mandatory days is the few days leading up to the mandatory day, because I think most of the smart money sits those days out.
Interesting.
And I've just noticed over time, I think those days pay more than they should. And I think the mandatory days are starting to pay less than they should. So I'm honestly more apt to play it on Friday afternoon, the day before the Saturday forced out, than I am on Saturday.
That's very interesting. I'm working on something with our mutual friend, John Camardo, about that notion of these pick sixes and what they quote unquote should pay. And looking at some other factors too, like field size. To me, it was so notable, and I haven't really looked into the data, but just going by feel, so notable how badly the New Year's Eve force out at Aqueduct paid, especially beating a couple of odds on favorites in the sequence, compared to how well I thought the one paid on Cigar Mile Day. I'm thinking that the overall field size might have something to do with that. Specifically, the fact that when you have many fewer combinations mathematically, it might be enabling computer bettors to wager more efficiently and therefore draining. I'm not trying to make computer bettors the bad guy here, Tony Joe. Don't get upset with me. But, and we'll have you on soon to talk anyway about, give your perspective on this. But I do think you have to think about the impact that computer teams have in terms of market efficiency. And I think when you get a force out with not as many potential combinations, they tend to be frighteningly efficient. What's your take on this and your approach to mandatory payouts in general, where we are right now?
No, I think you're exactly right. I think they've got the ability to play their best so efficiently that they've really drained a lot of the opportunity away. There was one, I think the mandatory at Churchill Fall Meet just, you know, a month or two ago. It paid horribly, in my opinion, for the combination that came in. And I hit it and was unbelievably disappointed in what it paid. I mean, I think it was a $20 winner that beat a 4-5 shot or an even money horse, and a couple other favorites got beaten. It's still just, it paid terribly. So I think those guys, you know, they provide a lot of liquidity, but they also suck some of the efficiency out, or they suck the inefficiencies out, because they can play these combinations so much more efficient than you can without an algorithm. And that really determines not just in mandatory pools, but in all pools now, you really need to think about what types of horses are overpaying consistently and where the computer programs could be weaker. And those are the horses you need to start betting on. Very hard to do. I have a feeling you asked me how you do that.
Yeah, exactly.
To figure it out.
Or if you had any specific theories. Yeah, I was just curious if you any areas for exploration as far as that goes. I feel like that's where it gets. It should be possible. And I mean, Garrett talked about it a little bit, wanting to look more at races like turf races, where the data itself that's getting baked into computer programs might not be correct. It seemed to me that he was indicating that that's one area where you could maybe still find some of those inefficiencies. Where are you seeing them in 2020?
I think he's right about turf racing. I think, you know, I think there's my figures that I make are more different in turf racing than fire figures or time form figures or whatever figures than they are in dirt racing. And that leads to some really good results and some really bad results. You know, some pretty frustrating results when my number is way different and I make a substantial bet and I'm just wrong. You know, I've made the number bad or whatever. But I think in general, the most success I've had and the horses that to me still offer pretty good value are just horses that have shown some hidden improvement in their pace lines. And by pace line, I just mean the pace figures and late pace figure in conjunction with that final time figure. You know, maybe a horse's final figure is the same or even a point or two slower than its previous race, but its pace line as a whole looks better. So there's just some hidden improvement there. I think those horses go off with plenty of value. And then, you know, Garrett's right. The races and the race types that have less information available provide better betting opportunities. But it's, you know, those are also your strike rate in those races is probably going to go down just because there's less information.
Let's talk about your overall business plan doing this as a professional. Are you looking to grind out profits over time? Are you of the view that it's the big scores that are going to make most of your money at the end of the year and the rest of it is just treading water? How do you describe how you make money playing the horses?
Usually at the end of the year, I can go back and pinpoint a handful of bets that made my entire year. And the rest of them are just trading money around and waiting for those scores to come along. That's just how my personal history has gone. I think there's different ways to go about it, but typically, you know, I can find the one or two big payoffs I've gotten that have made my entire year, while the rest of it is just churning along.
Let's return to the pick six idea. And this can be a question that maybe you have to answer it in two different ways, talking about the old pick sixes and carryovers versus the force out days. But I'm curious how you make the decision of when to play. Are you going to play automatically, or what determines what you're going to play? How do you construct wagers differently? And is there any rule of thumb in terms of how much you're going to invest relative to the pool size on a day with a big carryover?
I guess first I'll say I'm not automatically going to play. I sort of let my overall results dictate that. If I'm going good and my recent results have been good and I have a proper bankroll to work with, then I'm more likely to play most carryovers. But if things are going bad and I need to preserve capital, or I just feel like I'm not picking well at that particular track, or don't see any real edge to playing that pool, then I'm not going to play. As you know, in terms of how much I allocate, it really just depends on the sequence and what opportunity I see in that sequence. You know, it could be something very little, you know, very small bet, but very concentrated. Or if I'm really right, I'll hit it and hit it for pretty good money. Or it could be one of those sequences where there's just a lot of extra money in it, in the pool, and there's races that look like you got vulnerable favorites and you can get a pretty good payoff. I'll allocate more to that one. You know, just looking for that score that could make your year. But I don't really have any set rules. You know, a lot of my betting is by feel and by.
Will you be more inclusive typically on those days in your construction?
Yes, but I'm not 100% sure if that's the right way to go about it. I think ideally you would just bet your opinions versus using horses just to hit the bet, if that makes sense. You know, there's times where I've, you know, really liked a horse and thought it was a single, but then, you know, Chad Brown's got something in there that I just don't want to get beat by. And that's more of just a psychological thing. I'm more apt to use the Chad to some degree, you know, as a saver or something than I should be. I feel like if you just really stuck to your opinion and bet it more aggressively, that's probably the proper way to do it.
I guess the logic would be because there's more of a player's edge in theory, or at least less of a takeout. So therefore, it makes sense to spend more money in the pool, but not necessarily to spend that money being spready, to spend that money to maximize what you can take out of the pool. As I think about it now, that does make more sense. It makes more sense to spend more, but not necessarily to cover more in a fearful way.
Right. That's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, you always just want to make sure you've allocated your betting dollars as efficiently as possible based on your opinion. But at the same time, you know, I've seen hundreds of instances over the years where somebody will play a pick four or a pick five and, you know, like a price horse and get that horse home and get, you know, one or two other decent prices in the sequence and not have the obvious winner of the last race covered because there's, quote, no value in playing the favorite and get beat for big money by a 2-to-1 shot. That's totally obvious. I've seen it so many times that, you know, if you have infinite time and infinite money to play this game, maybe you can do that, but you've got to, like I was saying before, you've got to cash tickets eventually to stay around and stay in the game. So if you're constantly getting beat by no, quote, no value horses, you can go broke faster than your score comes.
So, no doubt.
You know, it's that old stock market analogy. The market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent.
Yep.
Whatever it is.
I've argued with people about this very issue. I've heard people say, if the horse is an underlay, it's an underlay and you shouldn't play it. And I just think, to me, it's just game selection. If the horse is an underlay in the win pool, you shouldn't bet to win on it. We can agree about that 100%. But I believe there are times when that horse can still lead to a value play in a different betting environment, like certainly the pick six, and maybe even the pick four. I don't know. Where's your attitude on that? That same horse that we agree you should probably have covered on the end, that maybe if God came down from heaven and said the price, it's a 5-to-2 shot and it's going to go off, and everybody knows it's going to go off at 2-to-1 and 9-to-5. I'll still use that horse in a pick six. What other horizontal pools would you consider using that horse in, or potentially all of them?
I wouldn't use it in all of them. You know, I've typically played doubles and pick threes as aggressive kill bet only type bets, where I'll purposely not use those horses. But in like a pick five or a pick six, even some pick fours, less so the pick four now, but the pick four before it became the 50-cent pick four, when you could still get paid, I would use that horse. You know, you might not allocate all your money to that. You know, you might just use it as a saver, and you don't want to lose a $2,000 pick four score when the 8-to-1 shot wins, and the 2-to-1 shot wins the last race that offers no value, because to me that's just dumb. I mean,
I guess you could argue, hey, in that pick four example, maybe you could find another way to leverage the horses who are going to pay. So, I mean, that factors into
sure.
it too.
Yeah, absolutely. It does. And that's where, you know, I'll play, use the different pools in different ways. So, you know, hopefully I would have a pick three ending on my 8-1 shot that I love and score out there to where if I miss the pick four, it's not that big a deal. But if you're only playing the one bet, you know, in the instances I've seen, you know, where the guys will miss out on a score because, you know, they leave off an obvious favorite, they're not playing all the pools. They're playing the pick four. Yeah. You know, they're getting six guys to put up $100. You can play a $600 pick four ticket, and you know, I'm playing it because I like the horse in the third leg at 10-1, and I miss it. Those are the huge mistakes. You know, you've got to use, if your value play wins, you've got to hit that bet because they're hard to hit. I mean, if you're just going to make one or two pick four plays a day, you can go a hell of a long time without cashing anything. But, you know, like I'll play the pick sequences around the pick four or within the pick four also. I'll play doubles and pick threes. You know, use them in different ways to just maximize my pin.
We could go another hour easy here, but we're coming up on time, and I can't let you get out of here, of course, without telling us about the day you're going to pick as your most memorable day at the races.
I had two candidates.
You can sketch both if you want.
Well, the first one, I'll just briefly tell you both of them, if that works. And
yeah,
you can
totally
edit one out if you want to.
No, no, we'll leave them for the podcast, but we'll probably pick one for the book. But maybe I'll work the other one in the body.
So the first one was sort of goes along with what we were talking about. It was a mandatory payoff day. It was one of the very early mandatory payoff rainbow days at Gulfstream. And it came on a Sunday. I'm sorry, it came, I think it was a Saturday afternoon. And it was just happened to be in April during the Keeneland meet. So I was at the track, you know, sitting in Mike's office. And it was just a random day where every friend that I have in Lexington just happened to text me at some point that day and say, hey, I'm at Keeneland. Are you in the office? And I said, yeah, I'm here. Just come up. So we had, you know, I had 10 or 12 people. And Mike and I had been working on this mandatory day. We liked the horse in the last race. It was the one horse. It was a turf race, a bad turf race. I want to say it was a maiden claim turf race, turf route at Gulfstream. And so he and I put a play together, a pretty substantial play. And, you know, I was telling my buddies about it. If you guys want a little piece of this play, you can have as much or as little as you want. So everybody bought in to some degree. I mean, some guys bought in for $2, some guys bought in for $100. And we're all sitting there in the office and, you know, just having fun. We hit the first five legs. We're live to our single. And the last race at Keeneland had just ended. So after the last race at Keeneland, anybody can go into the bluegrass room at that point because of simulcasting. So I gathered all these yahoos out, but we walked down to the bluegrass room to see Mike going through the tickets, sorting out what ticket's alive, what ticket's dead, what ticket's alive, what ticket's dead, and then figuring out how much we were alive for. And, you know, we figured out it was paying like $900 for 20 cents, something like that. Maybe $1,000, $1,100, somewhere right around $1,000 for 20 cents. So we had it 80 times. And so I went back to the table with all my friends and figured out exactly what everybody was alive to. And, you know, I was alive for about 42,000 personally, I think. And some of my friends were alive to close to 1,000. That was, you know, huge for them. And some of them were alive to a couple hundred, and everybody was happy. So this horse gets a perfect trip, makes the lead in the stretch, looks home free. Oh. And then something comes flying on the outside, and it's a photo, and it's a tight photo. But knowing the way the photos work down at Gulfstream, I knew we got beat. The outside almost always wins those photos. I was just standing there staring at the screen. Jesus, you know, it was cheap for me, excuse my language, because it was going to be a huge score. But I felt really bad for that photo, and they didn't. you know, they didn't know, they still all thought we won. You know, having to sit there and watch them go through the photo process of, you know, 2 or 3 minutes and then hanging the 12 horse up instead of the one horse and everybody losing all at once. It was very memorable, but very brutal.
I think it's appropriate for a pro player to have the memorable story be a beat, the way that those can be things that teach us so much.
Yeah, on that particular day, I went out and made a big exacta ball. Our single with two horses in cash bets of 10 or 12 thousand. So I actually felt okay at the end of the day. And it's, you know, it's a big difference between 40,000 and 10,000, but it took some of the sting out for me. The other most memorable day is just a little, it's not really a big score. It was a nice score, but it was just a personal situation that has always stuck with me. When I decided to drop out of college to be a professional gambler, it was the hardest decision I've ever had to make. And the hardest thing I've ever done is to talk to my parents about it, particularly my mother. She was a school teacher and values education and was understandably concerned about the path I was trying to take. And that meant a lot to me. You know, it was very important to me to prove to her that what I was attempting wasn't totally idiotic and to, you know, have her approval and support. And she would always support me, but just I wanted her to know that it was possible to do, and it wasn't a totally insane pursuit. And so not long after I dropped out of school, mom, dad, and my sister, we all went to Keeneland one, I think it was a Sunday, it was the spring meet, I remember. And, you know, I was technically playing for a living because I didn't have a job. But by no means at this point would I call myself a professional. I didn't handle my business in a professional manner necessarily, but I was, you know, my income was coming from races. And, you know, this is the first time she had come to the track with me. And there was I believe it was a pick four at Keeneland that I liked I liked one of these 6 or 8 to 1 separated horses we've talked about. And it won, and 2 other decent horses won, and then I go into the last leg, pretty good coverage, and a D-Wayne Lucas first time starting one. I have no clue who it was, but I end up hitting this thing. Yeah, I bet like $100 and got back over 5,000, and that's always, you know, that was sort of the day that she really started to understand that I might know what I'm doing, and wasn't as apprehensive about it after that day. And it's always, you know, it's a great memory of mine.
That's fantastic. And I can see why, while it wasn't the most memorable win in terms of dollars, in terms of your overall life trajectory, that would be meaningful. Do you remember anything particular about the horses involved that day, other than the details you shared already?
I have vague memories. The horse that I had singled was an older stake horse. It was not a graded horse, but just one of those stakes races. Keeneland would, you know, 9 furlong stake races they would run for older horses. I want to say that was a Neil Howard horse, but I'm not 100% sure.
That would fit. That would certainly fit.
And there was a turf race in the sequence that I, you know, and I started making my own late pace figures for turf races only back then. And one of my late pace horses won the turf race. And then I know it was a D-Wayne first time starter that won the last leg, but I can't remember the fourth, you know, the other leg to it at all. So I was thinking, you know, before we started chatting, I really don't remember if it was the early or the late pick four. But I think it was the late, but it might have actually been the early pick four.
the Lucas Furster thing, was it a buzz horse? Was there, and what was the angle on that? Was that an angle that you liked? Wait, Lucas first time at Keeneland back then?
Well, yeah, back then. I mean, this is back when Lucas was still Lucas to some degree. I mean, it wasn't Lucas of the '80s, but it, you know, it wasn't Lucas now either. You know, that was back when he still got horses and they would run. So I threw it in. And it was a maiden race where a couple of them had run okay, but it just looked like the type of race a Furster could win. I paid a little more attention back then to some of Jim Quinn's sort of rules about class that he talked about in his Handicapper's Condition book that he wrote, where, you know, maiden special weight races where the ones that had run hadn't run close to par, and those races were more typically won by well-meant Fursters, stuff like that. I paid a little more attention to that stuff back then. Yeah,
especially a meet like Keeneland, I would imagine.
Exactly, yeah.
The calculation you were doing for the late pace for the turf winner, where would you have gotten that from? Brohammer? Or Quinn again, maybe?
It might have been Quinn again, yeah. It was just sort of a rough... And I think back then I was just using like raw times, you know. Horse A finished in 23-1, horse B finished in 23-3, stuff like that. And would just get it, you know, pull it right out of the PPs and jot it down somewhere. I'm not sure I was actually making a figure for it yet at that point.
Just looking at the raw closing fraction and
right.
Who knows? There may have been signal in it, there may not have been, but it got the job done on that day.
Right.
I think in truth, sometimes that stuff is so ignored. It wouldn't shock me if somebody, as long as it was like looking at horses on a consistent surface, was getting some valuable information looking at just raw come home times in 2020, or do you think it's totally irrelevant now?
You know, it's interesting. John Camardo asked me the exact same question 2 days ago.
That's funny.
And I think there probably is some signal in it. I think in the segments of the race, there's probably some signal in it. But as an overall, like, final time thing, I think we all know that you've got to adjust those finals. But there might still be some signal in just raw sectionals like Trackus puts up.
Turn time or closing sectional, yeah, things like that. It'd be interesting. Somebody like John can study it and actually give us a real answer potentially, which could be kind of fun, unless he wants to hold that one for himself.
If we could drag him back out of Hong Kong anytime soon.
Yeah, you saw that article he wrote that got picked up everywhere about for Free Data Friday. Yeah. What a great perspective.
Tremendous article.
Yeah. For those who didn't see it, John was just talking about how his natural instinct is to play USA Racing. And as a guy who knows how to build computer models and things like that, lamenting the quality and availability of information here, as opposed to around the world, where he's been able to accomplish as much in a couple of weeks as it took him years to do here. Definitely something you'd like to see our friends at the Jockey Club paying attention to when we're looking at, you know, not just trying to find new fans of the game, but trying to find the people who are going to become the next Sean Borman and actually support this industry by trying to wager upon it on a regular basis. And I'll let you wrap this up with just a simple question about your general feeling about the state of the game as it pertains to someone like you, who is essentially an annuity for racing in terms of the money you contribute to the business through the bets that you make. Are you, as you know, you hear somebody like Garrett Skiba, who obviously you think about a lot of things the same way as, talk about why he's refraining from wagering on racing to the degree that he used to. Where are you with the racing business in general right now?
Well, you know, I'm very concerned. I think a lot of the stuff Garrett talked about and a lot of what John talked about in his article is absolutely right. It's concerning that I'm basically tied to an industry that just feels like a dying industry. You know, I would much rather be in Garrett or John's position to where they can step back and still have an income stream from a day job or whatever to rely on than be in my position to where, you know, I'm decades away from retirement in an industry that just doesn't feel like it's got decades left at a sustainable level. So it's very concerning. I think it's correctable if people would wake up. I mean, John Camardo is a perfect example. The guy that just got into this business 2 years ago and is already saying, I'm done with U.S. racing. The young, smart guy that knows how to use big data. And he's working on getting that data from Hong Kong and from Europe. And that, you know, if the higher ups in this industry can't see that, then we are all screwed.
Fair enough. I think we'll leave it there. Not the most optimistic note to end on, but I will point out that even that you do allow for the opportunity for the industry to start reading these tea leaves that have become more like skywriting than tea leaves about some of the steps that need to be taken in terms of pricing, in terms of data, and so many other concerns that we've talked about in other forums and don't need to belabor here. But Sean, I think we might have to do part two of this sooner rather than later, because we hit on a lot, but we left a lot of stones unturned. But most of all, I just want to thank you for the time and effort you put into your appearance on the show today. We will have you back soon here and then hopefully on these Keeneland shows again soon.
I would love to. I always love talking to you.
Cheers, my friend. Before we get out of here today, I do want to bring in another guest. It's awards season, as anybody knows, and while most of the awards don't do much to float my boat, I do pay very close attention to the Beamy Awards. They're happening this Friday night, and I'm happy to welcome back to our airwaves, Jason Beam. Jason, how are you?
Peter, always good to talk to you guys.
Is it true that you have decided to wear one tuxedo for the entire awards season? Was that you?
No. Because I care about the environment. Was that what that guy?
That was the idea. That was the You are Joaquin Phoenix. I always confuse the two.
Yeah, the Beamies are more of a pajama and a tank top. Well, there was one year I did a comparison between Janine Edwards, who was hosting the eclipses, and me laying in my bed in my pajamas. And it was one of my better tweets, I think.
Oh, fantastic stuff. How have the preparations been going, in all seriousness?
It's weirdly stressful. I mean, I know it's a stupid little thing, but there's just a lot of little things to take care of. But I think it'll be fun, and I hope it will be. And, you know, it's a strange night because, like, the notifications just kind of blow up for a little while. And, it's just a weird night, but it's always fun.
I remember the first year you did it, and I think we had you on the old show shortly thereafter, and waking up in the morning and just I had gone to bed early, and just having this reaction, mm-hmm. looking at notifications and or seeing things that have been trending, and just, what the heck are the Beamy Awards? We have to figure out what this is. And it seems to have just snowballed from there. We do have a lot of new listeners. We're getting new listeners all the time, new fans coming into racing. Some of them, or those who have been living under a rock, may not know what the Beamy Awards are. Tell the audience what they're going to be getting themselves into this Friday night.
What I always tell people, the best way to explain it is, it's really not an award show. It's supposed to be a comedy show, and it's supposed to just be a couple hours to have fun with racing Twitter. And, you know, most people kind of put aside any little grudges and just kind of have fun for a few hours and kind of laugh at some of the silliness that occurs in our world of horse racing, because, as you guys know and talk about, there's plenty of it. And so it all germinates from my Twitter account. You know, we have the awards. I mean, it's not a meritocracy of any kind. It's usually just, if I think I can make something funny out of it, then we'll do it. And so, and we do some video stuff, and you know, like we do a little, like a mock in memoriam, not actually of people who died, but of you know, maybe traditions or things that went away throughout the year, like Steve Asmussen's hair, etc.
We did all mourn that pretty seriously.
Those were beautiful. The locks were incredible.
Red carpet ceremony. I know that's been part of it in the past.
Yeah, that's been that's kind of what we've been working on the last couple of days. Because our method, I have a little team that helps me. And our methodology is just throughout the year, if we see anything funny, we throw it in our little joint folder. And the red carpet's kind of been the last little bits of preparation for this week. So, but I think it'll be fun.
What time is the show on Friday? When do things get underway?
We start at 8:30 Eastern for the red carpet and 9 for the show, and the goal is to be done by 10:30 or 10:45. It's funny, Pete. Timing is one of the big issues, because the East Coasters, you don't want to keep them up too late, and the West Coasters get mad because they, you know, if they get stuck at work or they're in traffic. So the only Rowans that really get it good are the folks in the flyover country.
That's amazing. For folks following after the fact, what's the best thing to do? Just to go to your Twitter feed and look at that as a hub?
Yeah, that and I tell everybody that's you know, participating and watching along to hashtag all their tweets Beamy Awards. So that way people can watch on demand.
There you go, the on-demand Beamy Awards. I want to talk to you about the sponsorship that you've gotten for the last couple of years.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty impressive for a web fake awards show to have a sponsor.
it was so nice. Like I said, the group that helps me, I mean, they donate plenty of their time. And so I'm glad that I can get them paid a little bit and make it a little more worthwhile. Yeah, the nice folks at Little Red Feather, who I'm friends with Billy and Gary, who are the two chief guys on that. And they've just been they've been big supporters of mine personally and now a little bit professionally. So, and then Sim Horse Racing also participates in sponsorship, which is kind of a, what's the term? Now I'm going to forget. Not virtual reality, but, you know, kind of a, that kind of a horse racing game.
I want to talk to you a little bit about what's going on in your life as well.
Yeah.
Last we talked to you, you were at Monmouth Park. How was the rest of that experience? And what are you mostly working on at the moment?
Yeah, Monmouth was awesome. I mean, from going there, it's just a really, really special place. And so to get to call races there was a real, real treat. And got to go to Colonial, which was great. And even got to go down to Gulfstream West for a month, which is it's nice to have to go to Miami in November.
That, yes.
That's a great little ending to my long work summer that was. As far as, I still do the podcast every day for Twin Spires. And then as far as announcing, I think it's going to be similar, but it was kind of one of those things where it's like, hey, let's all touch base in February and see where we're at kind of thing. So
nothing official. Your rebranded podcast, we should point out.
I got traded.
I thought you just literally changed the name, but I guess in terms of departments, it's true.
You know what it was? Yeah, it was essentially, I got under the wing of DeRosa and Ed, the Twin Spires guy, and Bet America's kind of shifted a little more towards sports, so it made sense to move our horse racing podcast over to the auspices of Twin Spires. But, I mean, really all that changed was the name. I mean, my paycheck still comes from the same place. So I will say it is, Pete, it is really cool when your paycheck comes from KentuckyDerby.com. I don't know why, it just makes me happy.
That is cool. There's something there's something fulfilling about that. They shouldn't shouldn't pay you any less, but it definitely gets cool points. Will you be at the NHC this year? I know I've had the pleasure of being on your show to recap the NHC a couple of times. Are you going to be out there yourself? And any chance we can reconvene around then?
I am. I'm going to be. Yeah. I just got my approval notice like 2 days ago. So I'll be down there for. I usually go down for the weekend, and then I stay for an extra week. Just get a hotel off the strip and enjoy the desert. In fact, funny story, Peter. I had you on to recap the NHC last year. And I had just accepted the Monmouth position like 45 minutes before I interviewed you. So I interviewed you and I couldn't tell. I couldn't say anything, of course. So I interviewed you. I was very giddy that day.
I thought I heard a little bit of extra pep in your voice. Now little, it's explained.
Little pep in the step, pal.
Excellent stuff. All right. The Beamy Awards Friday night. Follow your Twitter, which is just at Beamy Awards. You can also follow that hashtag. It's going to be a lot of fun. I look forward to seeing what Jason and his team come up with. And I want to thank you for coming on the show today. And I look forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks out in Vegas.
Of course. Give my best to JK and the whole team over there.
Will do, my friend. All right. We'll thank Jason Beam. We'll thank Sean Borman. We'll thank our sponsors, including 10 Strike Racing, Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation, Stats Racelands. We've got some special Stats Racelands content coming up very soon, a little bit about preparing for the NHC. That should be a lot of fun for folks to check out. Most of all, though, I want to thank all of you for listening, asking questions on Twitter, interacting with us. That's what makes this so much fun to do. This show's been a production of In the Money Media. In the Money Media's business manager is Drew Cotney. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos. I can do right.